Mr. Chairman, friends, it has, of course, become something of a ritual, but it's not only in the spirit of ritual that I wish to thank the Australia India Institute for inviting me here and for inviting me as part of this wonderfully diverse group. I would like to warn or assure, I'm not quite sure what the word is, that I must unmistakably be a part of the diversity that has been assembled here. I'm very happy to be here, but I've been inhabiting a sort of, how should I put it, a kind of magical universe the last 2 days, as it were, there are large entities that are the agents of social and historical process. There are states and nations that want, they desire, they seek, and things like that. And since my own engagement with sort of social process is some rather below that large abstract level, I like to think in terms of people and how they relate with the world and you know and what they think and so on. So I have been able to formulate to myself my sense of wonder at the kind of things I was doing and how wonderfully different it was from what I was planning to do here. I was asked, broadly speaking, to talk about India's language diversity and policies and things like that. And India's linguistic diversity is like everything else about India, full of big numbers. So no matter where one starts with India, you know, this is Grierson's Linguistic Survey of India, early 20th century, 364 languages and dialects. The people of India survey done by Kumar Suresh Singh, which was initiated in 1985 and published in, naturally, 43 volumes. I talked about 325 languages divided into 5 language families and using 25 scripts and so on. You know, yet another census, 1991, 1,576 mother tongues, which is fair enough, why not? But in addition to 1,576 mother tongues, there were 1,796 things that were under the category other mother tongues, which of course left me completely baffled. I have no idea what other mother tongues are. However, as a consequence of this, obviously, language and linguistic assertion has been a very important part of the process of nation formation in India. And as anyone who knows anything about intimacy knows, the fact that language and nation formation have been intimately connected does not mean that it has been an easy relationship. It's been an intimate, but often a very difficult relationship. And obviously these intimate workings of nation and language can be thought of at various different levels, but I'm not going to try and race through an 8,000 word paper in 20 minutes. So I'm going to skip much of that. And what I'm trying to do here is to actually try and address the larger question through the way in which English has functioned and continues to function in our national life. Once again, English, the question of English is intimately bound up with Indian nationalism, both with the emergence of Indian nationalism, it is argued indeed that English indeed enables the nation first to be brought to mind, qua nation, in the 19th century. Certainly, English also figures very strongly in the nationalist imagination as a language of the colonial oppressor, so that there is a great movement within nationalism to reject English. And then the Constitution of India struggles, that many people have referred to, struggles with the question of English and what is to be done with English, so that English is not really one of the languages of the nation, but still ends up being retained at the end of a long, complicated and fascinating constitutional process as an additional associate official language. And so English is, as far as I'm concerned, an entree into the conundrum of India. It's one way. Obviously, there are many others, but it's one way of beginning to think about India as a kind of puzzle. And it's unlike the world in which I've been, listening to things in the last couple of days. This has to do with cultural factors and with the way in which, as it were, life is lived, the way the times are experienced by the people who are living those times, rather than from some high location. There are many phases to this engagement with English, and again, I won't take very long, but the first that I would like to refer to is something that I associate with my years as a student in the 1960s, when this was the phase of the nationalist rejection of English. This is the movement that in UP was called Angrezi Hatao. All right. English was the language of the colonial oppressor. We would have nothing to do with it. And out with English, blackboards were, signboards were painted over, and so on. You know, that kind of thing went on. And clearly the understanding was that English was in the way. English was standing in the way of the assertion of the languages of India, and consequently of the people of India, and the way for them to come forward was to remove English. So there was a kind of zero-sum game that was happening. I mention zero-sum game because, of course, this period of nationalist rejection of English has led, in the recent past, to the global or globalizing embrace of English. So suddenly English is welcome, desired, actively sought, and actively made available. So I was talking to someone, and he said, well, you know, what has happened really is, and this obviously fits in with the euphoric narrative of globalization, we are in a situation in which, of course, we are at the end of zero-sum games. We have entered a regime of abundance. And therefore, there is now no conflict between one and the other. Everybody can thrive. So that big media companies are subtitling their work in Hindi. So Hindi grows and there's stuff there. On the other hand, there is English, and English is being made available to everyone. And so one has that expression, beloved of management types, which is called win-win. So we have a win-win. There is this wonderful euphoric world in which there are no losers. So be it. I was reminded, however, and indeed grateful for that, of Tolstoy's opening sentence from Anna Karenina about happy families being all alike. That if indeed it was win-win, of course we wouldn't need a conference at all. Because happy families don't make for good stories. There's not much you can do with happy families. And I'm afraid, at least the way I tell this narrative, it's not quite win-win. I wish it were. I dearly hope I'm wrong. But anyway, let me say what I want to say. To come back to English and the way English functions, I want to get two, as it were, common misunderstandings out of the way, and these misunderstandings derive one from the phase of the nationalist rejection of English, and the second from the globalizing embrace of English. The first can be summarized briefly as English is not ours, it belongs to them, we have got rid of them, we wish to have nothing more to do with it. Simple. The other misunderstanding, almost exactly opposite, would be expressed in a phrase that certainly people who are fresh from India would recognize immediately. English is ours only. Right? It's ours. And we can take it and we can do what with it, and it's ours and we can possess the world. I suspect that both of these positions are untenable. English is ours, but it is ours with a very special kind of historical baggage. It comes as part of a kind of historical conjuncture. And that burden of history which sits on the presence of English in India and its social location in India is not something that can be wished away by any kind of euphoric narrative. I'm afraid it doesn't happen that way. However, to introduce one more player into this story, I'm doing okay for time, am I?
Sure.
Yeah, good. One more player into the story, and because they've been talked about this morning as well, this was, the young, what is known as the youth bulge, not a very attractive word, but it's used constantly. And according to the 2001 census, 60% or more of our population is or will soon be under 30. And this has been spoken of as a kind of youth dividend. That somehow this is going to work to our advantage, and it's good, this large and growing workforce that is going to help us to outstrip China, of course. So now I just want to enter. I'm not quite sure about that. I don't understand. I'm not an economist. I don't understand the way these things work. But I am reminded nonetheless of another dividend, which some of us may remember, which was the peace dividend, which was supposed to happen at the end of the Cold War, 1989. And some of us may remember what happened to the peace dividend. It seemed to evaporate somewhere. I don't know at what point the peace dividend was lost, but somehow the bonanza that was supposed to happen at the end of the Cold War, when funds were to be available for all good things, seems not to have happened. And I dearly wish someone would tell me what happened. But anyway, so as with the peace dividend, I'm a little wary of the youth dividend. However, let me bring the story to English and the way in which this burgeoning market of young people who are entering the job market, or hoping to enter the job market more precisely, seeking employment, and therefore driving a vast sector which is experiencing explosive growth, which is the English coaching school. The coaching academy, so that everywhere, all over India, anyone who has a few square feet of space and something that sounds like English to to people who don't know English can make a fortune. It's there, and it's waiting to be made. I don't want to mock this. I have actually, as part of the research for this, I've sat in on some coaching center classes, and what one sees there is a deeply moving spectacle. These are people who have pooled their limited resources in the hope of acquiring something that is going to make them a part of the modern world. They want it desperately, and this is something that is going to give them not merely call center employment, that is the least of it, but there's more than that. Beyond that, as it were, there is international access, there is the glowing world of globalization. Everything waits at the end of that call center diploma. And this is moving, decidedly significant. I'm not quite sure what it's significant of, but it is significant because it indicates that there is this huge constituency of people who are ready and wanting, in both senses, both not having and wishing to have. This desire is not a kind of passive, neutral kind of wanting. And I want to give a couple of examples of what I mean. The title of the paper that I've submitted here was the tagline of an advertising campaign that was run by one of the kind of mobile service providers, Uninor, as a matter of fact. I don't know whether they're still providing, because they were probably caught up in the 2G scam, but never mind. They ran a very successful, or certainly very visible, advertising campaign, and the tagline was, "Ab Mera Number Hai." The advertising campaign figured, had these young, determined, square-jawed faces, ready, eager, impatient to inherit the future. And the line was simply, "It's my turn now." And the message certainly for someone like me was, step aside. It's my turn now. Okay? And for instance, again, my town where I was doing this research, all right, was plastered with, again, with advertisements for a coaching academy called, interestingly enough, Trounce Coaching Academy. And again, the tagline was, forgive me, but it is essential to get the flavor of contemporary India that Hindi and English are mixed. Ab confidence se baatein hongi English mein. Alright? So it's, English holds the promise of participating in modernity with all its joys. Alright? And so it's not merely employment, it's also, you know, it's also conviviality, a kind of social mobility and things. The name, interestingly enough, is Trounce. Now, I don't think that the violent associations of Trounce are necessarily intended in the name. I suspect that it might merely be, Trounce may merely be a very emphatic form of winning. You know, that you not merely win, but that you really, really, really win. I don't know. I suspect. But it's possible that there is something more. That in this eagerness, there is, if not already an anger, certainly the possibility of an anger, of a kind of rage, a kind of impatience to inherit the world. Okay? And it is this kind of impatience which is really something that I wish to add to the debate here, add to the consideration here, because English is merely one manifestation of this desire to be included, inclusive India. So the desire to be included is a very real one. The desire is to be included. English holds the promise of inclusion. Okay, and the puzzle, and the slightly complicated puzzle that I want to place before you is that English is simultaneously the possibility of inclusion and the near certainty of a certain kind of exclusion as well. The same thing, it is that same, the kind of the globish, the coaching center English that you acquire, which you think is the, which one hopes is the passport to modernity and inclusion in the world, also becomes that which reinforces exclusion, right? So this is a slightly complicated argument that I want to put, but this is, for instance, a couple of years back, a Dalit activist had proposed that Chandrabhan Prasad proposed that a new goddess was to be added to the pantheon, and the goddess was English. Because it was in fact through worshipping the divinity English that the hitherto excluded untouchables would gain access. And I recognize and respect what drives it. What drives that demand, I can see what the subtext of that longing to create a temple to English means. My fear, however, is that if by some improbable miracle it were possible for everybody in India, right, with Indian numbers, suddenly to acquire English, to be fluent and, you know, transparently, possess the language, would we usher in a utopia immediately, or would privilege find other forms of reinforcing itself? I rather fear it is the latter, that the symbolic triumphs of acquiring English would not translate necessarily into revolution, you know. I mean, to put the question very bluntly, is the avidity of the demand for English a reinforcement of the structure of privilege, or is it a challenge to it? I suspect that it is both. I suspect that it is both a challenge to that structure of privilege and a reinforcement of it. And it's, and to me, the explosive potential of English in India at the moment derives precisely from this doubleness. The fact that it is both of these at the same time. Or, finally, to bring it back to the revolution in the title, in the phenomenon of this explosive growth of English and the English Coaching Academy, are we seeing the revolution? Or is this the containment of the revolution? Or is it merely the prelude to what Zizek in a recent piece in the London Review of Books calls the zero degree revolution? This is the revolution which is rage. He's talking about the English happenings, the kind of youth riots of the last few weeks. But it's of a rage which is without focus, of an explosion of resentment, but without any specific demands. So that it is a lot of people who are unhappy and don't like the world the way the world is, except that there is nothing, there's no imagination of what it is that they actually want. So the question that I want to raise via English is precisely what exactly are we preparing for in this phenomenon? Anyway, I will... I better stop here. I think I've taken all the time I need to. Thank you very much.